Now, this is Box to Box with Rob Gilbert and Michael Edgley.
Oh, what a goal!
For Chemist Warehouse, great savings every day. And Hoyt's Herbs and Spices, changing the mood of food.
Absolutely fantastic!
Hello and welcome to Box, the show that is everything football. Here with Rob Gilbert and Michael Edgley to run the rule over the past week in the World Game. First edition news shortly, and our former ITN journo turned pundit Derek Dyson will be joining us throughout the show as Willem van Denderen continues his travels across Albania. But first up, the Matildas are now on a three-week break off the back of their successful farewell ahead of the Olympics, passing a stern test against the nine times Asian champions China, helmed by their former manager Ante Milicic. And while they've ascended many peaks over time to achieve their status as the most loved Australian team, off the back of the wild success of the Women's World Cup, they now have the podium summit in sight, and it begins in Paris just 46 days away. Tony Gustafsson has named his squad, the players are primed, and the expectation will only build from here with the base of 11.5 million viewers to build from. Alarm clocks will be set across the country for 3 a.m. as the team begins its campaign against Germany in Marseille on Friday, July 26 our time. Can they get the job done without the predator firepower of one of the game's most elite players in the squad? We'll discuss it all with one of the pioneers of women's football around the world and prime mover behind the creation of the very first World Cup, our very own Heather Reid. Then, while we've covered the Euros and Olympics extensively, the coming months will host a feast of football with the Copa America kicking off in 10 days' time in the USA in what will be a prelude to the 2026 FIFA World Cup they'll jointly host with Canada and Mexico. Argentina, 15 times winner, defending Copa and World Cup champions, begin their defence against Canada in Atlanta. In what might be his last appearance in the tournament, Lionel Messi will lead the Albiceleste. And who better to discuss it all with than one of our favourite guests from The Guardian, Marcela Mora y Araujo. Now, Edge, you're still travelling. You're in Mexico City as we speak.
Yes, I'm in Mexico City, laying down some contingency plans for the World Cup in 2026 in the event that Australia qualify, of course, and drawn to play in Mexico. It's a very interesting place. I've had the odd taco too, Rob.
I wouldn't have expected anything less. A burrito. I've had spent some lovely time in Mexico when I was younger. You just got to ensure that you stay on the right side of town. But it's a beautiful city, a beautiful country, I should say, and a beautiful city, Mexico City. And Derek, you're in the Healesville Sanctuary on this King's Birthday long weekend.
Yes, a very wet Healesville Sanctuary today. I think I'd much rather be in Mexico City. I seem to remember there's a good opening scene to a Bond film shot in Mexico City. So that's my only knowledge of it.
I think that was Spectre, the Day of the Dead you're referring to, as we carry on from some of the fun we had with last week, referencing The Godfather. I know you're a big fan of Ian Fleming's books, and Bond, well, probably not quite on the level of The Godfather trilogy for me, but certainly one of my favourites. Ed, you look like you got something to say.
I was just about to say that some of the things I've seen on the streets here in Mexico City, they are straight out of a Bond movie. It's pretty interesting things going on here, I can tell you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. All right, well, let's get into the news now. Last week, we flipped the script with both the national sides in the headlines. So with no club football and the green and gold still in the local stories, we're going to do it all again and start with the Socceroos and Matilda Central for the green and gold army. Now, Edge, you can still join the Paris trip to watch the Matildas. We're going to talk to Heather Reid in a moment. It is just getting more and more exciting. You'll travel to Marseille, to Lyon, 11 nights. Melissa Barbieri will be there. Special functions. If somebody has got that time, or they can take a couple of weeks off on annual leave to get over there to the Olympics, I mean, there's no other way you're going to get a decent ticket to the Olympics at this short notice. That you said last week the drawbridge was about to be closed. It must be sort of creaking down as we speak.
It is. Next weekend, it will well and truly draw shut. We've only got four spaces left on the tour. So we had four people book during the last week. So, yeah, it's going to be fantastic. Obviously, for the French Riviera, the Côte d'Azur, Marseille and Nice and up to Aix-en-Provence and Lyon and all the wonderful things that the French, the south of France has to offer, not to mention supporting the Matildas in the away terrace and enjoying it with a bunch of fantastic Matildas fans. It's terribly exciting. We've been to France many times and we know our way around that part of France really well, and we're just so excited that we'll be back. And obviously, really interested to talk to Heather Reid in a moment, just to see the level of optimism. Heather keeps her finger on the pulse around the key players in the Women's Football Network in Australia, and it'd be interesting to see what her feeling is about the expectations for the team.
Yeah, exactly. And that very team has been announced. The 18-strong Matildas team to compete in Paris 2024 was named by the Australian Olympic Committee at Sydney Olympic Park on Tuesday. Captained by Steph Catley, the team features 8 athletes who will become the first Australian footballers to compete at 3 games. Catley, vice-captains Emily Van Egmond and Ellie Carpenter, Mackenzie Arnold, Caitlin Ford, Alana Kennedy, Claire Polkinghorne and Tamika Yallop, Kyra Cooney-Cross, Mary Fowler, Katrina Gorry, Michelle Heyman, Tegan Micah, Hayley Russo will all play in their second games, while Claire Hunt, Caitlin Torpy, Courtney Vine and Claire Wheeler will make their debut. The Matildas go off to Paris off the back of their best ever finish in Olympic football, the 4th in the delayed Tokyo Games 3 years ago, losing an agonising bronze medal playoff to the USA. In a pool with 4-time gold medalists, the USA, the 2016 champions Germany and rising African nation Zambia, who beat Nigeria in the 3rd-place playoff in the recent women's AFCON. The team will open their campaign, as we said, before the opening ceremony on the 25th of July against Germany in Marseille. So, Edge, this is just so exciting. We talked for many years in the lead-up to the Women's World Cup in Australia and New Zealand just about how big it would be. Of course, the Olympic tournament is not as big as the World Cup, but, hey, an Olympic gold medal, silver, bronze, whatever, is prestigious in anyone's language.
It certainly is, and it's a great another tool to raise the profile and continue to reinforce the brand of the Matildas home in Australia, because we know Australia is one of the most significant Olympic countries. We take it seriously and love the Olympics, and the Matildas will be one of the very key, key events for the Australian Olympic team at the Olympic Games. Everybody will be watching. Yeah, very exciting. It all, for me, comes down to that first game against Germany, Rob, because only 12 teams in the Olympics, so the top 2 teams from each group qualify for the quarterfinals, and a lucky loser, the 2 best third teams. So we must get something out of the first game against Germany, and then, you know, you'd think we'd do okay against Zambia, and then we can have a throw at the stumps against the septic tanks in the third game.
I haven't heard that one for a while. Yeah, Germans, of course, let's not forget, they're a powerhouse. They were, you know, the beaten champions, second place getters against the English women in that famous Euros one, the Lionesses one. So they will be a fair dinkum difficult nut to crack.
They will, won't they?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. And as our mate Joey Lynch wrote for ESPN, the Australian footballing public didn't have to wait too long to see what they wanted to see. That was, of course, the 18-year-old Nesri Nkunda, one of the most promising talents the domestic game has produced in decades. But what followed wasn't a particularly memorable game for Nkunda or his teammates. Graham Arnold believed it was a dangerous fixture given the state of the pitch, which you're going to talk about a little later, Edge, at the Bashundra Kings Arena in Dakar, and so it proved.
Long range effort deflected. Oh, that's unfortunate for Bangladesh, but Australia won't care. Aidan Drustic, least of all. It'll probably go down as an own goal. A heavy deflection. But that strike from Aidan Drustic and that puff out of the cheeks from Graham Arnold tells you that finally Australia have the breakthrough. However, luckily, Boss. See if he can get better quality. That's not bad. 2-0. Cassidy Yenge. Textbook header from a rare, accurate cross for Australia. And they're 2-0 to the good.
And that, of course, was our very good friend Simon Hill. And thank you to 10 Paramount Plus for allowing us to use that footage. Australia will play Palestine in Perth. Many of our listeners will be tuning into the podcast on Tuesday morning, our time, for the final match of the second stage of qualifying before the third round offering direct entry to the 2026 World Cup commences in September. So, Ed, you're going to expand on the state of the pitch, et cetera, and we're going to talk a little bit more about some of the players in that squad and their debuts. But they got the job done, 2-0. You'll take that. Get out of there.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to talk about the state of the pitch in World Cup corner. We'll go into a bit of detail. That's obviously a big talking point. Nestori Nkunda's debut. I think he did pretty well, actually, considering the conditions that were delivered for the team. But Rob, Paramount Plus taking the world feed. I don't know if you watched it. I got up at 3 a.m. in Mexico City to watch it, and it looked like the production company over in Bangladesh were shooting the game with Vaseline all over the lens.
Yeah, well, look, to be fair, I mentioned Simon Hill, and you just have to go to his Twitter feed. And look, Simon, as we know, he's an honest bloke. He calls it as he sees it. But in some circumstances, look, I don't need to tell you, Edge, you're the world traveller and you go to all of these events. We know that some of these countries who are emerging from having no opportunity to participate in events like this, to being at least on the same stage, don't have the same capacity, both economically and from a logistical and technical point of view, to deliver these things. So I sort of take the point of Simon, and I think you do agree with this, that as disappointing as it is to see poor quality, I'd rather that than none at all. And hopefully it's the starting point for a nation like Bangladesh.
Yeah, it is. It is. No, and the fact that we've got it at all, I mean, there wasn't long ago that we didn't see these games. But it is what it is. It's a difficult, a country like Bangladesh is really, just emerging out of the depths of the FIFA rankings. I think they're well into the 160. So, and we do normally give them a belting, but yeah, the pitch quality and the broadcast, it's all part of Asian football. We've got to accept it. But, I mean, we can comment on it, can't we?
No, we can comment.
I kept rubbing my eyes thinking I was tired, but then I realised there was something on the lens.
Yeah, it was. Okay. Moving right along. Now, there was a slightly better picture coming out insofar as quality, but the result didn't reflect that quality. At Wembley, as the grand send-off for the Euros, they hoped would be a triumph, ended in, well, a disaster is probably too big a word, given that some of the players were probably trying to avoid injury. Others had not trained or played for a month or so. But the BBC pundits were mightily unimpressed as Iceland, with John Dagur Thorsteinsson, scored the only goal as they won 1-0. And they won't be going there to Germany. Of course, they were famously beaten by Ukraine in that final setup of playoffs. Dion Dublin, who, as many of our listeners will be aware, is a former Three Lions player, in fact, from 1998, he said, "Nobody really had a good game tonight. There's not really one player in an England shirt who will say, 'I've done my bit, I've earned my shirt.' They just seemed off it tonight. I don't know if they came into this with a little bit of expectation. I didn't see any partnerships working." He goes on, Iceland famously, Derek, knocked Roy Hodgson's team out in the final 16 of the Euros 8 years ago. What do you make of this? I know Southgate tried to put a positive spin on it, but he would have to. He's got no choice to do that. And you are going to talk about it more in stoppage time. So just sort of give us your top line view of that game.
Well, the Talkback radio stations are in meltdown in the UK, and certainly have been for the last 24 hours. People questioning whether Gareth Southgate should have the job, calls for other managers to come in, calls for Grealish and Marcus Rashford to be reinstated into the squad. As usual, the hysteria around this England team in big tournament time is very much there. Yeah, you're right. It wasn't a disaster. It certainly wasn't the way they would have liked it to gone. The biggest disaster was John Stones limping off. Now, he's the one centre-back that Gareth Southgate can rely on. Obviously, Harry Maguire will not be in this squad. And Gareth Southgate will be praying that Stones makes a recovery for the first game against Serbia, or else he'll need to call up a replacement. Possibly Jarrod Branthwaite of Everton might come in. But not what England wanted. A positive spin would be at least they got it out the way now. But there will be other teams in this tournament, like Serbia, like Slovenia, that will set up with a low block. They'll hand the ball over to England and say, "Go on then, break us down." And England did manage to do this against the minnows of Iceland. So yeah, there's a bit of a cloud forming over Wembley and St George's Park, I'd say.
We'll tune into stoppage time a little later in the week. We'll break it down even further. Okay, that gets us going. I'm really looking forward, Edge, to our chat with Heather Reid. She is somebody who looms large in Australian football and women's football in particular. We're going to have a chat to her about the Trailblazers documentary as well, which if you haven't seen, you need to see.
Have you watched the Trailblazers, Rob?
I watched it yesterday. It's fantastic. And, I did feel quite satisfied that, we began this podcast and made the determination from the very get-go that we were going to give equal time to both the women's and the men's game. And I think we've fulfilled that charter that we agreed on. And some of the things and the stories that are showcased in that documentary that we've discussed, and we've interviewed many of the people that are in the documentary over time and talked about some of these conversations. You know, we actually started the year that the strike happened, you'll recall, back in 2015.
It was a big issue, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. So just from a pure sporting point of view, even if you've got no interest in football, it's one of those ones that we see so often these days where, you know, people are drawn into sports. You look at Drive to Survive as a good example for Formula One, where it brings in new people. So I love the fact that the stories of sport are being told from the point of view of the people, from the history, and we're understanding a lot more of it. So yeah, Heather, I'm sure we'll have a lot to say about that as we, you know, get into a bit of a deep dive with her ahead of the Matildas heading off, mate.
Well, let's get her on after the break.
Okay, stand by. Heather Reid next on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse. Great savings every day. And Hoyt's Herbs and Spices. Changing the mood of food.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
Yes, this is Box to Box. And as I said off the top, only 46 days till the Paris Olympics. And whilst there will be many Australian sporting heroes that come out of those games, the most anticipated for many will, of course, be, can the Matildas finally ascend the podium and finish in the top three, if not win the whole thing? We've been watching the farewell games against China, where after a bit of a stuttering start, they got the job done. And someone who watches women's football closer than anybody in this country is, of course, one of the pioneers of the game, not just in this country, but around the world, our very good friend, Heather Reid. How are you, Heather?
I'm pretty well, thank you, Rob. It's a beautiful sunny day here on the Sunshine Coast. So, looking forward to a lovely afternoon.
Yeah, well, we're all over the world here today. I'm in Chile, Melbourne, Edge is in Mexico City. He'll jump in a minute. But, Heather, before we get into the farewell games and then talk a little more about the Matildas' chances, I just wanted to start off by asking you about the Trailblazers documentary on Stan. I watched it yesterday. We've covered over the past decade a lot of these stories on the show. We had a deep dive in our Offsiders podcast, which I encourage any of our listeners to have a listen to, where we talk to you about your history with the Matildas over the years. But that Trailblazers podcast, that documentary was a long time coming, and it must be just so deeply satisfying for you to know that it's now out there and the full story of the Matildas is getting known around the country and the world.
Yeah, look, I've been privileged to be working with the producers in a small capacity with some, you know, fact-checking as well as, you know, sourcing people for the interviews and, of course, participating in the Trailblazers documentary myself. It's been a couple of years in the making. It's the only documentary that's full production team of women and women who are absolutely dedicated to promoting women's football. And I have to say, I was really quite emotional when I watched the first screening, the preview in February. I cried a little bit. There's some stories in there that are really heart-wrenching, things that I didn't know about and people would be surprised to hear, I think, on some of the stories being told by the players. But, you know, this is a documentary that is both uplifting and also informative in so many ways. And I think one of the most important things to remember is that it's not a full history of the women's game. That would be impossible to do in 35 minutes. But it's a documentary that highlights the significant times in our history where change has occurred, and especially in the last 10 years or so with when the national team went on strike in 2015, they were no longer on contract and they didn't have to go to, they refused to go to America to play a victory tour for the US team. So it talks about the strike and what culminated from that. It also talks about the introduction of a collective bargaining agreement and the importance of having better employment conditions and terms for athletes in the first iteration and, of course, in the most recent edition. And it really points to those people, women and a couple of blokes as well, who have been the true trailblazers, who have facilitated change that has led to what we now see in unprecedented ways of popularity and success for our women's game in Australia.
Yeah, it's really quite incredible what we've seen in the past few years since the respect that the Matildas were entitled to for so many years is now finally being given. Encourage all of our listeners to make it their business to watch that documentary and really to take the first step if they haven't already in understanding it. But to segue into the conversation ahead of the Olympics, Heather, the China Games were never going to be easy. China is a powerhouse in international women's football and has been for many, many years. So to think, particularly under Ante Milicic, who pretty much knows everything that's going on under the hood at the Matildas, you would have expected a test and they got it. But they managed to shake it off. And if anything, as much as it's devastating that Sam Kerr won't be there, Tony Gustafsson has had plenty of time to prepare this squad without her. And we saw that.
Yeah. Look, I was very impressed with China, especially in the first game in Adelaide. And, you know, I've been, as you said, following this game for a long time, way back in 1988 when we had the Pilot World Cup in China, and China was definitely making big moves to be a powerhouse in women's football. And then they hosted the first World Cup in 91. Then they dropped off a little bit from the international radar. I'm not sure why, but they're back. And, you know, Asian champions, Milicic landing himself a pretty decent little gig there. And credit to the coaches who have worked with those players in the past 4 to 6 years as well. But Milicic really understood what was involved, and that first game in Adelaide gave the Matildas a real shake. Clearly, some players were still tired and recovering from, you know, travel back and forward across the world for either, you know, the All-Stars game or other games. The All-Stars versus Arsenal, that was, with three Australian players in the Arsenal team. But I think China looked much stronger and more robust than I've seen them before. That was still the case in the second game in Sydney, but the Aussies had just had a little bit more time to recover and to analyse and to understand what they needed to do to get back on top, and they clearly did that in the second game.
Heather, Olympic Games. Rob mentioned at the beginning of this segment, 48 days to go. The squad's been announced. What are your expectations of the Matildas at the Olympics? And without talisman Samantha Kerr, Michelle Heyman, one of your favourites, is going to step up. But what are you expecting out of the Australian women's team at the Olympic Games?
Look, I think they'll go extremely well. And I don't think many people involved in football were surprised to know that Sam wouldn't make the squad. I mean, she only incurred her injury in February, I think it was, January, February. That's a miraculous recovery if she was going to be there. But, you know, Gustafsson's found a terrific replacement, like for like, in Heyman. She's playing out of her skin. She's happier than ever on the field, off the field. She showed that again in particularly the second game against China, how well she's going. Look, I'm just staggered to think that there are eight players in our Australian team. We can't call them Matildas for the Olympic Games, but in the Aussie team, eight players are in for their third Olympic Games. Now, that experience of people like Kat Lee and Carpenter and Arnold and Ford, Kennedy, etc., is got to be good also when it's backed up by another eight players who are in for their second Olympic Games. Hard to believe that, you know, players like Fowler and Cooney Cross were playing in Japan, you know, 21 for the Olympic Games then. But I think it's a squad that's got great depth. I'm really happy to see the debutantes in Wheeler and Torpy and Hunt, and of course Vine in there as well. I think they'll go well. They've got to get off to a big start, a good start. In their first match, I mean, they've got it's tough at this level because there's only 12 teams, Michael, let's face it. But, you know, USA, Germany and Zambia, not necessarily in that order. I think their first game is against Germany. So that's going to be a real telling tale when they run out onto that pitch in Marseille. And hopefully if they can get a point or 3 points from Germany, then they're well and truly on their way to the semi-finals.
Something we talk about on this program a lot is the future of women's football at the Olympic Games. The recent AFC and FIFA congresses in Bangkok just a few weeks ago AFC announced an Asian Champions League for women next season, which is adding a significant number of games to the teams that qualify for that. And most of the players in the Asian Champions League for women in Asia will be national team players. And also the FIFA Club World Cup, FIFA's outlined a women's version of that is coming down the pipeline too. So considering FIFA's development and the continual development of women's football, do you think there'll be any momentum behind potentially senior women being withdrawn from the Olympics and replaced by the under 23 category? The reason I say that is that the calendar is going to get busier and busier and busier. Would that be a shame, or do you think that would be a logical occurrence because of the development of the game?
Yeah, look, it's a really polarising question, Michael. I think, first of all, how good is it to finally have so many opportunities for women in the world game? You know, we battled over 50 years when there was a ban on women playing, and when that ban was lifted in the 1970s, there was great, great efforts around the world to, first of all, get a World Cup and then get Olympic status for women. That Olympic status in almost every other sport is absolutely critical in terms of profile and status and funding and all sorts of other things that go with that status. And let's remember, you know, a week in September 1993, when the IOC announced that a women's football competition would be admitted to the Olympic Games for 96, and also in the same week, Sydney would host a 2000 Olympic Games. Our sport took off as a result of those decisions because there was money thrown into the game for full-time athletes at the AIS. There were scholarship programs around the country. There was profile given to this sport like nothing beforehand. Not to mention even the calendar, the Matildas calendar that was released for 2000. I still strongly believe that it was a calendar that put the Matildas name on the world map. But it also, you know, brought great profile to the players. So, Michael, I think, you know, if we're going to follow the men's model of going to 23s, for example, we've also got to look at the checkered history of men's involvement in the Olympics since 1900. And it was in, it was out, it was in, it was out, largely because FIFA and the IOC couldn't agree on the regulations around the rules of amateurism. Now, we've got to keep in mind that for all intents and purposes, the Olympic Games is still a sort of for amateur athletes, regardless of what's happened with the introduction of tennis and golf and basketball, where there are professional athletes playing. My understanding is, though, that FIFA wanted the men's competition to be under 23 with a few older players, so it didn't dilute the integrity of the men's World Cup. The men's World Cup will always be the biggest event, the biggest event on their calendar. The women's competition, as we see these other events that you mentioned, the Asian Champions League, etc., coming in, there may need to be some review of the calendar and the scheduling. But I think from the players' point of view, they love going to this multi-sport event where they're rubbing shoulders with high-profile elite athletes from all these different sports, all these different countries. I mean, I remember them talking about being in the village in 2000 and just how exciting it was to see, you know, the top-level basketballers or the swimmers or the, you know, all these athletes from other sports. So I think we've got to keep in mind that people love the status of being an Olympian. They, for most countries, the Olympics is the be-all and end-all. I can understand for European countries it might not be the same case, especially in football. But how good is it going to be playing against a country like Zambia that may never be on the world stage apart from a once-off Women's World Cup every 4 years, when the eyes of the world are looking at a women's event rather than an event where the focus is on the nationality of the participant?
You know why Zambia is there? It's because 12 of the top 20 ranked nations in women's football are not at the event because of the structure of qualification. So there's no England, who are ranked 2 in the world, no Sweden, who's ranked 6, no Netherlands, who are ranked 8, no North Korea, Denmark, Italy and Iceland, who are 11, 13, 14 and 15. So, yeah, there is a question mark over the status of the Olympics, but well, it's a watch this space. And isn't it such a good discussion to have, because it means that women's football is developing, and we know the FIFA Women's World Cup is growing at exponential levels. I want you, the last question.
Quickly just say, I think that one issue is that there's only 12 teams in this competition. Yeah. And now we go back to the beginning. The teams in the competition qualification was the 8 quarterfinalists from the previous World Cup. So you had to make the World Cup. You had to make the quarterfinals in order to make the Olympics in 96. We were there in 2000 because we were host nation, and we've qualified through Asia ever since in 2004. Well, I think there's been a couple of times we weren't in the Olympics, but you know, I think the relevance of the Olympic Games to the athletes in particular is so strong. And yeah, we're not having England and Netherlands, but we are seeing Colombia and Zambia. And qualification is 2 countries per confederation. Maybe that needs to be looked at. Maybe if they could extend it to 16 teams, you might get more European teams where there's the powerhouse of women's football.
Yep, interesting discussion. But I'm going to ask you about an important question about a player that you know exceptionally well. She's had an enormous amount of mainstream media coverage, and that is the wonderful Lydia Williams, who will be going to the Olympic Games as the 3rd emergency goalkeeper, but obviously her presence within the group will be significant. But Lydia hung up the boots. It was a wonderful, wonderful night in Sydney where she received such an incredible farewell. Can you just give us your perspective of Lydia when you invited her to Canberra as a very young girl to play in the back in the early days of the W League?
Well, you know, I wear my emotions on my sleeve, Michael, so I hope I'm just going to hold it together here now, because I met Lydia when she was 15 years of age. She came to play for Canberra, and I think she is one of the most amazing athletes and one of the most amazing people that I've ever had the opportunity to work with and to know as a friend. And that extends to her family, Diana, and her dearly departed dad, Ron. I was privileged to speak at Ron's funeral memorial service at the Great Hall in Parliament House, the first person who had a memorial in the new Parliament House Great Hall, and I spoke on behalf of the football community with Lydia by my side. And it was such a moving occasion. And then all these years later, you know, nearly 20 years later, unfortunately, Ron passed away just before Lydia got to play for the Matildas, but we always say he's watching every single game. But to see that tribute to her the other night, first of all, the tribute in the Arsenal All-Stars game where they brought her off before halftime and we had an opportunity to thank her. And then the tribute again last week in Sydney was just outstanding. I mean, whoever came up with the concept of giving her that booker, the cape, the kangaroo skin cape, is just, they deserve a gold medal. That cape was made and designed by the daughter of Lydia's father's best friend, and all the way from Katanning in WA. And the cape features iconic symbols of her journey and her totem being the kangaroo and Ron's totem and her journey from Katanning to Canberra and then on to France, where she will complete her international career. I just can't speak highly enough of Lydia and what she has done to the sport. She led the team in its discussions over the strike in 2015. She's led the team with others through the discussions on the collective bargaining agreement. She's front and centre now of so many different campaigns, and I hope she finds her groove, either with the PFA or in her own business world, for life after football. That will no doubt always include some form of football content, but she's a fantastic person, and I just wish her all the best, and I hope that maybe she'll get a little touch of the play in France, who knows. I don't think that's not her mission. I think her mission is to continue to inform, educate and support the younger players in and around the Matildas, and she'll be there as a leader, as a mentor, and of course as a standby keeper if needed.
Yeah, well said, Heather. And it's often the case, isn't it, that third goalkeeper is somebody who is senior, who is there as a cultural member of a squad to represent what the team environment is all about, particularly to some of the newcomers, and to have a steady head and a cool demeanour as the tournament plays out, having been through a lot of the highs and lows of tournament play over recent times. Hey, before we let you go, Heather, you mentioned when we got this conversation going that you're confident that the Matildas can get the job done. But Emma Hayes, newly arrived at the USA, multiple champions themselves, Germany, another gold medal winner, Zambia, they were third in the recent AFCON, beat Nigeria in that tournament. So if the Matildas are going to get this job done, regardless of how many nations there are in the world, just to get out of this group is going to be an incredible challenge. Your expectations of how the tournament will start, what Gustafsson is going to set up, and ultimately, just give us a prediction of what colour you think the medal might be.
Yeah, I definitely think we'll be there in the top four at the end. Michael would have a better handle on the machinations if we get out of the group and where we go and who we're not likely to play. But as I said, we have to get off to a good start against Germany. I don't know what the bleary-eyed fans around Australia are going to be thinking at 3 o'clock in the morning on the 26th of July, but you know, there'll be lots of tea, lots of kettles being boiled, I'm sure, or maybe whiskey or something. It's tough. It's tough at this level, but I think, as I said, if we can get a good result against Germany, then we'll go on to do well against Zambia. I mean, Zambia's got one of the top strikers in the world in Barbara Bamba, is it? Unbelievable. And then, of course, USA at the end, keeping the best for that last game. Tony will well and truly know what to do by then. And we'll see where we go. But I'm pretty confident we can get out of the group. And as I said, Michael will understand where we go to from there and who is possibly going to be our opponents in the quarterfinals. Can I also just add a couple of other key points? You know, we're talking about Lydia and her significant contribution to the game. Next year, 2025, marks the 30th anniversary of the Matildas brand introduced for Sweden 95 and the 30th anniversary of Australia's participation in a World Cup, Sweden 95. It'd be great to have a sort of a celebration by bringing back the 95ers as a tribute, but also maybe naming something after Lydia Williams, whether it's a Williams trophy or a cup or a player of the tournament or something like that. But we've got two significant anniversaries to celebrate next year, and I think there's lots of opportunities for the PFA, the APL and Football Australia to recognise and celebrate that great history.
Yeah, that's a good point there, Heather, and we'll make sure that we explore that a little bit further after the Olympics are over. Maybe we'll get you on and have a conversation about what that looks like and how we can play a role in advocating for all of that. These milestones need to be recognised and our heritage showcased to all of these new fans. So yeah, it's an important thing. Heather, we'll let you go. Enjoy the Olympics. Maybe we'll talk to you during it if we get the chance. And hopefully,
yep,
we'll all be celebrating when it all comes to an end, and the next big chapter of the Matildas is written in Australian sport.
Terrific. Thanks, Rob. Thanks, Michael. Not too many tacos, Michael, while you're over there.
I'll try not to. I've had a few already. I'll probably need to lay off them.
Heather Reid, it's great talking to Heather always. Okay, after the break, we're going to talk to Marcela Mora-Iheraho from The Guardian. The Copa America is only 10 days away. Even if there wasn't an Olympics or a Euros, that'd be in the spotlight for football-loving fans. It is for Marcela. We're going to talk to her next. Oh, Chemist Warehouse time. Edge, have you seen a Chemist Warehouse in Mexico City? I'm watching you take a selfie with one of your friends as we go, and I cross to you. Chemist Warehouse, downtown Mexico City. I bet you they could do with one there. There's a few people there.
They could do with Chemist Warehouse in Mexico City, absolutely, because, there's some, I'm sure it would do very well, but I haven't seen one, Rob.
No, you haven't. Well, if you're in Australia, as I did yesterday, as it's chuckles in the background, I was down at my local Chemist Warehouse in Camberwell, and I took advantage of the Swiss Ultivite men's deal, 120 tablets, and I paid just $35.99 for them. That was better than half price. Absolutely fantastic. I didn't need to buy the Swiss UltiBoost Liver Detox 120 tablets for $21.99, but Derek, I bought some of the fish oil because some of my joints after my marathon running days are a little bit creaky as I try to drag my weary carcass around the golf courses these days. I find the fish oil's really good.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the fish oil, Rob, particularly the what they like, non-scented. So you just pop them in, give it a swallow, and you know that you're all covered.
Absolutely, exactly. You well said. They don't smell or taste like fish at all. Chock-a-block with all those really good omega-3 fatty acids, the DHA, the EPA. You get it all with the Swiss fish oil. Now, remember, if you're on regular medication for chronic conditions like high blood pressure, cholesterol, which was what I was in there for, getting my prescription filled, or diabetes, you can save more on those prescriptions throughout the year at Chemist Warehouse. Find out more in-store or at chemistwarehouse.com.au/prescriptions. Chemist Warehouse, the great savings are every single day.
Box to box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse. Great savings every day. And Hoyt's Herbs and Spices. Changing the mood of food.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
Yes, this is Box to Box. We just had a really good chat with Heather Reid about the Matildas' chances in the upcoming Olympics, one of the three huge sporting events that are on our doorstep, with, of course, the Euros coming up a week away, and in 10 days' time, the Copa America, one of the time-honoured footballing tournaments with such a glorious history, and a nation that has only one equivalent in winning that very title is, of course, Argentina. And our very good friend who covers the Albiceleste so closely from The Guardian is Marcela More Iharao, and we welcome her back to the show. How are you, Marcela?
Hi, how are you?
All the better for speaking to you. I was just saying to you off air, I remember the last time we talked was as you were bathed in the afterglow of the glory of Argentina winning that World Cup in Qatar, coming off the canvas, having been beaten by Saudi Arabia, and then winning the whole shooting match and defending champions going into this Copa, Marcela. And I guess the question I've got is this Messi's final Copa, and what confidence do you have that they can defend their title?
So I think everyone's kind of wondering when Messi's going to bow out of the world stage. It's actually his birthday on the 24th of June. So he will be celebrating his birthday in between games. I think there is very much a plan that he will make it somehow as a participant of the Argentina squad to the World Cup 2026. I don't know if he'll play in it, but he's definitely, you know, Argentina have vested enormous efforts and resources to build a training camp in Miami, to kind of relocate almost there. They've been there now. They're playing a couple of friendlies in the US just before the Copa. And in fact, Scaloni said yesterday in a press conference that I think they're playing a friendly today, Sunday. I'm not sure what the time zones are. I'm in Germany now, weirdly, so I'm confused as to what day it is where in the world. But they're playing a friendly against Ecuador in Chicago as a kind of pre-Copa. And Scaloni said Messi will play a few minutes, so people don't have to worry if they've bought tickets. They will see him. But he won't play the full time because I want to rotate players and give everybody a chance. And I'm not sure yet who's starting and who's going to last the whole hog, because we're trying everyone out in different positions. And I interpreted this as saying, you know, the whole Messi in the US kind of chapter, which is post-World Cup, post-Copa America 21 victory, post-Messi being a kind of national icon for Argentina and delivering these titles, is about Messi as entertainment. You know, the whole US approach to soccer or football or whatever you want to call it is also about selling tickets and merch and getting the crowds excited, and it's a different kind of proposition to the passion-led South American thing. So I think people go to watch Messi very much. That is very much what happens. You know, people buy tickets to watch Messi play, and they don't support the club or the country particularly. And that, I believe, is what we're going to see in this Copa, very much so.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, interesting. It does talk to the proliferation of entertainment programs built around sport that we're seeing around the world, doesn't it, Marcella? And the fact that that these sporting stars are now multimedia entertainment stars, and that that Lionel Messi, for all of his greatness as a player, has a far greater profile around him than just what we see on the park. And that first game is against Canada, an invited team to the Copa this time. The group that Argentina will play in includes Peru and Chile. You can't really see too many problems for Argentina getting out of this group, but there are plenty of stumbling blocks on the way. Chile, two times winner. Peru, as Australia knows, are a nation with bucket loads of passion. And the Canadians, well, their women are some of the best teams in the world. So we see Canada rising, as we do with the USA, and with the World Cup coming up on your American continental doorstep in 2 years' time, they'll be wanting to show that they're capable of mixing it with the world's best. So do you see problems with that group at all?
I don't see problems with the opening group particularly. I mean, you know, there's always surprises. You just mentioned we spoke after Argentina lost to Saudi Arabia in their opening game of the World Cup. So I'd say, never say never. I think USA had a particularly bad experience again in one of these warm-up friendlies against Brazil earlier, and I was just reading some of the coach's remarks that he was saying, we're beyond bad, this is a wake-up call. So I think everyone's slightly kind of taking it quite seriously and thinking, oh, what's going to happen? I think, you know, always watch out for Uruguay, Brazil, Argentina, Paraguay, even in Copa America. Whoever goes through, that could be a challenge. I do think Argentina are on a bit of a high in terms of confidence, and that can be both beneficial and work against. Chile have surprised Argentina before. In fact, the Copa America 2016, which was a kind of bona fide Copa, an added tournament, a sort of centenary celebration in the US, led to Messi resigning after the whole tournament, almost weeping, saying, I've had enough, I can't bear this. The pressure of representing Argentina is too great. And he resigned pitch side, having lost to Chile in the final. So I think, you know, you can never tell before the tournament even begins who's going to surprise, who's going to, it's a kind of delicate alchemy of being well prepared, having the players, being well trained, and then a ton of luck and a whole load of other, like, you know, psychological factors, witchcraft, whatever you want to call it, also collaborating for things to work out well. What I do think is that Argentina are very much filling in the role of, you know, World Cup title holders, Messi entourage or cultural context. You know, as I say, they've got this base in Miami. They're doing a ton of commercial stuff, like, you know, from coaching leaders to selling staff, academies. It's a real kind of a real migration to Miami, if you like, the Argentinian Football Association. There's a real sense that they're going to be there for a while, until 2026 anyway. And I think they're gonna wear the badge of best in the world throughout the Copa. Obviously, if they lose horribly the first three games and they're out, then we'll all have to recalibrate. But I expect they will go through the first three games. Not because the other teams aren't good, but because it's very much the commercial expectation. I come back to this idea of this being entertainment above all. It's always strange when the US hosts the football tournament, because we, we think of them as not being a particularly football-loving nation, but they're certainly very expert at hosting big events. So there's a sense that, you know, that things will go smoothly. And I say that with the caveat of the 1994 World Cup, when Argentina were again sort of favourites and doing very well initially, and then Maradona got suddenly expelled from the tournament. So the biggest kind of drug bust in footballing history. So, you know, fingers crossed and touching wood, we'll see minutes of Messi peppered throughout until mid-July.
Marcelo, if you read any previews of this tournament, Brazil have been put forward as the main competition to Argentina, as perennially they always are. But obviously several players heading into these finals in great form. Rodrigo and Vinny Jr. of course won the Champions League very recently, amongst others. The form line isn't great for Brazil, but as we speak, they have just beaten Mexico 3-2 with a very, very late goal from Hendrick, the emerging star there. What do you feel, how do you feel Brazil are coming into the tournament? And does the emergence of a player like Hendrick make the Argentine in you a bit nervous that they've uncovered another gem that could light up a tournament?
I think, I mean, I don't think it's the Argentine that's nervous. I think Brazil are always a force to be reckoned with. And as you say, they've got these young players who've had an incredible kind of experience in European club football, which is the true elite level of the game. I'm more alert to Uruguay, for example, than Brazil. I think something happened against Brazil whereby the neighbours, the sibling relationship, I mean, countries aren't that afraid. You know, I think Brazil has a sort of effect on non-South American opponents of thinking, oh, Brazil. But Argentina, Uruguay, they don't worry about Brazil particularly. And it's almost like there's a special relish in defeating. And again, you know, the player-by-player, Argentina does have that kind of talent and players who have had a similar experience of doing incredibly well in the super, super competitive demands of European football. So I would be more nervous about having to face Uruguay at some point than Brazil personally. But that doesn't mean anything, because ultimately, it's just on the day, isn't it? I think if you're asking me, do I think Brazil will do well in the tournament generally, my answer would be yes, I do. And I expect, again, you know, Uruguay, Brazil and Argentina to be there for some time, if not the entire tournament. But it's impossible to know. There's always surprises. And I rate Colombia at the moment as well for no particular reason, rather than I've just enjoyed what little I've seen of them. It's hard to know beforehand. I think doing very well against Mexico is not, you know, is not something that would get Brazil going, oh, yes, we've done it. You know, I think that's an expected, it's almost an expected result for them.
Well, you mentioned Uruguay before. They're obviously managed by Marcelo Bielsa. And for people like myself who are a bit more Euro-centric, we last saw him kind of leaving his job in Leeds with not up the blaze of glory that I'm sure he would have hoped for. What has he done with Uruguay, you know, resource-wise, population-wise? You know, they're just not in the same conversation as Argentina or Brazil or even Colombia, I suspect, as well. So what has he been doing to to put them in the top of the conversation for the title as you have them?
Well, Bielsa is a very special character, and I don't think we can say that he's done a single thing that would transform a country's fortunes. But the first thing he did was with Uruguay was play against Argentina in Argentina after Argentina won the World Cup and beat them thoroughly, and you know, so that he's a kind of kindly professor that can come back and go, well done, son, but this is how it's really done. And it was actually quite a moving moment when, you know, all the young Argentine management team who'd somehow grown up under the tutelage of Marcelo Bielsa were thoroughly kind of humbled by him and just lined up to give him a big hug and go, what an honour to be utterly thrashed by you on home ground. Other things he's done that have more to do with Uruguay, he left Luis Suarez out of the Uruguay squad for some time. He's now just recalled him, which is quite excellent. And I think that's the kind of approach he sort of has. No one's bigger than the team or the squad. Everyone needs to wait their turn. We're trying new people. We're working with the young. We're kind of forming a cohesive group and a way of doing things. And then now calling Luis Suarez back, having made him sit out for a bit. I think that's a very Bielsa thing to do, and I'm excited about what kind of football Luis Suarez might bring to the mix. The other great name of Uruguay and the legend of Uruguayan football, Cavani, is actually out now for the Copa. So again, that's a kind of, what's going to happen there? Cavani's been scoring goals for Boca Juniors relentlessly, and he has been a kind of pillar of Uruguayan identity, if you like, for the better part of, you know, decades. And so it's really a question of whether he'll be missed. But what Marcelo Bielsa does, apart from building an entire kind of psychological and philosophical approach around the game and making everybody love football again, whether it's Chile, which he did this with, or Leeds, he also has a sort of sudden, almost personal saboteur that says you can't really win everything. So I would be utterly amazed if Uruguay won the Copa America under Marcelo Bielsa, because I don't think he's a title hoarder. I think he's a teacher and a thinker. I would love it if they won it. I have to say, even as an Argentinian, I would absolutely love Uruguay to win the Copa, and I think I will support them thoroughly. But it would surprise me immensely, just because Bielsa has a really interesting and difficult relationship with actual triumph. But they will be delightful to watch, for sure. I mean, without a doubt. And as I say, you know, the traditionally Uruguay are the country that can go and face Argentina, face Brazil with not, you know, a single kind of nerve or worry in the kind of country's footballing psyche, if there is such a thing. They would never be scared or stage frightened out of doing their very best to defeat the Giants. So should those classic derbies come up at any point in the tournament, I would pay particular attention and tune in no matter what the time, because it will be a spectacular kind of delight to watch.
And Marcelo, you'll know that in Australia we have a very deep connection to Uruguay with our own stumbles to qualify in the World Cup for so many years. Argentina, of course, one of the nations that proved a bridge too far for so many years, and fascinating. It just gives an insight into your passion for the stories around football, that as a proud Argentinian, that with Uruguay on equal titles, 15 apiece with Argentina, that you'd be happy for Uruguay to win it. Now, before we let you go briefly, so when I reached out to you, I'd expected you to be in Buenos Aires, but you are a citizen of the world and you could find yourself just about anywhere when we talk to you. But you're in Berlin and you were at an event ahead of the Euros. So briefly tell us a little bit about that and why you find yourself in Berlin as we speak.
Well, it's a lovely event that's taking place here in Berlin called the Ballet of the Masses, which is an entire kind of, alongside the Euro tournament, an entire setup in the House of the Cultures of the World, sort of beautiful building, just a whole load of different art and installations and conversations about football, but not particularly the lineups and the tactics and the strategies of the teams, but different aspects, you know, from poetry, dance. I was speaking with Musa Okwonga, who's a wonderful Berlin-based English writer and podcaster. We were talking about culture and politics and, well, art, if you like, and football. But before us, there was a fantastic dance piece. There's a different installations using football commentary of games as poetry, music. And I think it's just one of those extraordinary things. It happened in 2006. I came to Berlin to an Argentina-Germany game in the World Cup. And I also stumbled across a couple of art exhibitions. One was entirely about the ball, and you could just sit next to these different old balls and put headphones on and listen to different stories and sounds all related to the ball on the pitch. And I just think it's a wonderful approach that Germany have, and I wish Argentina did the same when it hosts events or big games, just make sure the cultural weight of the city accompanies the event, you know, so you're going to get a lot of crowds coming to watch games, but also there's just a ton of cultural stuff relating to football, but culture really in the city going on as well. And it's just it just enhances how football is part of the cultural makeup of a society rather than just an event of its own.
Yeah, contextually to the point that you were making earlier on in this conversation of Messi, the Renaissance man, and football, the artistic piece alongside of the event itself. Thanks for giving us that insight, Marcella. Marcella, we will let you go now. It's very early hours. You are very kind to have gotten up so early for us. I'm sure there's a coffee and maybe something to enjoy with that coffee as the sun rises.
I'm in a no-smoking household, which is strange. Apparently Germans smoke more than anyone else in the world, but not where I am. So there you go.
I think the Greeks might have a fight with the Germans about that. But well, I didn't say it, but since you said it, it's one of the many evocative sounds that we have had talking to you over the time. I'd never forget the sound of you pouring that coffee and flicking the cigarette lighter as you were lighting up one to begin your day on one morning in Buenos Aires. It's beautiful, Marcella. You are one of the beautiful people of football, and you are very generous. Kind. No, you are the kind one, making sure that we have got someone of your stature to talk to about the Copa as it comes up. So, and I will be watching with interest, and maybe if I'll be cheeky enough at some point during the tournament, depending on how it all plays out, to drop you another message again.
Well, we'll see how Uruguay does, and the Bielsa, maybe we can relive the sort of bad forecasting from my end.
Yes, but it takes courage to forecast, doesn't it, Marcella? So maybe you might be the person who was the one that predicted the victory, and we will certainly give you all the credit that you deserve if you do have that that title. Marcella, have a great day, and we'll talk to you again real soon.
Thank you.
Marcella Mora I Araujo. If you haven't already subscribed to The Guardian, do yourself a favour. She writes some of the most wonderful prose on football, and her reflections on football and insights into the game and the broader feelings of football around the game. Okay, stick around. World Cup Corner next on Box to Box.
Willa, willa, willa. Everybody's going to buy Hoyt's Spices. Everyone's going to save a dollar or two. Everybody's going to buy Hoyt's Spices, yeah.
Well, well, well.
Ed, you getting any flavour-packed meals in Mexico City?
Surprisingly enough, you do. But I've got to say, the tacos here, obviously you can load up the all the different sort of sauces that make them very spicy and tasty, but the tacos themselves are not very tasty. It's the spices that you add on top. So maybe Hoyt's could open a outlet in Mexico City.
Oh, mate, they just do a fair dinkum raging business if they did, because you know that is the truth of the matter. The tacos are great. You get the corn chip tacos, or you get the flat.
I'll tell
ones.
You what is good though is the barbecued corn on the street for 15 Australian cents.
Yeah,
pretty good, pretty good, brother.
That is a deal. I love barbecued corn, and you can also put the spice rubs on.
What
barbecue.
Would you put on your barbecue corn? What are you the spice rub on the?
Okay,
corn?
So what I would do, I'd get my barbecue corn on the cob. I'd peel back the outer casing of the husk, and I'd make a spice rub of garlic, chili powder, paprika, smoked paprika, and a little onion powder as well. Maybe some cayenne, some smoky cayenne, a bit of salt and pepper in some oil, and I'd rub it in the corn, right? And then I'd barbecue that corn. And then what I'd do at the very end is I'd get some mayonnaise with some chipotle, and I'd make that chipotle mayonnaise, and I'd just brush it over the corn once it's been cooked. And then, just the finishing touch, I'd roll it in some microplaned Parmesan cheese. I'm telling you, it is absolutely... Derek, do you like the sound of that?
That was absolutely delicious. I did corn on the barbecue last night, and it was nowhere near as elaborate as what you've just said.
Well, you just rewind the episode when you know, make that barbecue corn next time, and I'm telling you, you will not be disappointed. You'll be happy with Hoyt's at Coles, Woolworths, and all good independent supermarkets.
Fill those empties with Hoyt's spices, yeah.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse. Great savings every day. And Hoyt's Herbs and Spices. Changing the mood of food.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
I had a lot of fun on the show this week, Edge. We're recording a little out of sequence. We typically record on a Monday night Australian time. For you, it could be any time anywhere in the world, but we're doing it on a Sunday afternoon on the King's birthday long weekend. The sort of timing of everything allowed us to do this a little bit more relaxed, and listening to Marcella just now from Berlin talking about the Copa America and Heather earlier on in the show, it's been great fun. But we touched on the Socceroos at the beginning, and we mentioned the state of the pitch. Now, we did discuss the footage coming in. That's a different thing from a technical point of view. But I want to ask you, is this the state of this pitch at the Bushundra Kings Arena in Dakar? Would that have been, do you think, quite deliberate insofar as a ploy to diminish the Australians' attacking ability? Or from your experience, is that just the state of football pitches that we see in some parts of the world?
Oh, look, I think if I was the Bangladesh coach and I was taking my job seriously, I would have flooded the thing as well, no doubt about it. But let's just, you know, it is... the beginning of the wet season in that part of the world, and it's raining a lot, and it is difficult. You know, they weren't allowed to train up before the game, and I think we have to recognise the development of football in those regions, like Bangladesh. You know, it's not just how good the players are; it's how good the facilities are, how talented the grounds people are, all of those things. So there is reasons that we'd probably cut them some slack, Rob, but. I just want to sort of talk about what Graham Arnold said. He said, the pitch, terrible, it's unacceptable, because we talk about player welfare and you're putting players on a field that players can get injured. And it's no shock to me that five or six players from Bangladesh went down with cramping, having cramps in calf muscles and hamstrings because the field is not good. I'm being honest, the field was dangerous. I'm not passing responsibility. The field, that was a field that we only won 2-0. We had chances to score five, six, or even seven. But some of the tackles, potential injuries, were stressing me out last night. And if you're like me and you watch things closely, he was agitated on the side of the pitch. He wasn't happy. So I think they were just happy to get out of that environment. I don't think he can really put any weight on that result, how it is. And, you know, for players like the key players, like Jackson Irvine, I also noted that he said after the game that he wanted to bring Jackson off much earlier, but it was only 1-0 and he didn't want to lose Jackson's leadership in the game. And it wasn't until the second goal went in that he quickly got Jackson off the field because, you know, they've been such a long season for some of these guys. And, yeah, look, international football, it's the vagaries, it's the challenge of it. It's a marathon. It's not a sprint. And, you know, we got out of going to Dhaka like that. I think the whole program that the Socceroos management managed was good. They were prepared in Bangkok in good conditions. They were able to acclimatise with the humidity and the hot weather. And they went across to Dhaka for, you know, one night and played the game, had a shower, something to eat, and got on the charter flight onto Perth. So, yeah, it is what it is. But the pitch, obviously, a big talking point. I want to ask Derek about Josh Nisbet. You watched a little bit of Josh, Derek, in the Central Coast Mariners treble-winning team. He was absolutely one of the key players. He's a very small man in stature. Interestingly enough, he's got an Italian passport. I don't know if you knew that, Rob, but he has. He's out of contract, and it's fair to say that Central Coast Mariners wish him all the best. They want him to go somewhere. I know that he's consulted Graham Arnold about what he should do. And what league do you think he's suited to where he can perform well and then, you know, press a claim for a World Cup spot? I think he'll start against Palestine in Perth in a few days' time. But given the size of the player, what do you think? Where do you think his management should be looking to place him? He's obviously the Johnny Warren Menace, best player in the league. He's got a high profile now. He's played for the Socceroos. What do you think? Where should he go?
Oh, look, I mean, the most obvious place is try and find a spot in the English pyramid somewhere, Edge. Many fine players of smaller stature have played in the game there. Obviously, the Premier League is now known for the teams being on the big side, and you know, maybe at that very elite level there might be a struggle, but surely there's a club further down the pyramid. Other than that, then you know you might look at somewhere like Japan. You know, potential, is that a step up? Would you call that a step up? The J League versus the A League. So
yeah,
Japan might be a good place to go. Well trodden path for Australian players.
Yeah, Thomas Deng is there, and obviously Mitchell Duke, you know, who is a starting number nine for the Socceroos, is plying his trade at Machida in the J1. So yeah, that would be a step up. Yeah, no doubt about it. He'd be good. I'm thinking that you know, some of the physical leagues in Europe he wouldn't be suited to, but some of the you know, more skillful leagues in Europe he would cope with too. But obviously a player like Josh, his career will really take off if he gets to play. You know, he needs to go somewhere where he can play. So maybe a Netherlands is a good opportunity for him. Maybe in Belgium, there's been a few players there. Even the Scottish Premier League at one of the bigger clubs, there's plenty of Socceroos that are regulars in the SPL in those days. But we wish him well, don't we, Rob? I mean, it's just a fantastic story. I hope he starts against Palestine. I think he will start against Palestine. And I hope the broader football community who don't necessarily watch the A-League get to see him in full flight. And hopefully they'll be as equally as impressed as what we are because we watch the A-League.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be a competitive match, regardless of the fact that both teams have qualified for that third round already. It's going to be at a proper football pitch where they're not playing it. And I was talking to Heather Reid off air about how interesting is it that the Socceroos will be playing at HBF Park against Palestine. but it wouldn't matter who the Matildas were playing these days anywhere, that you couldn't play it at a small football stadium. It would have had to have been played at Optus. An interesting sort of an intro insight into the status of both teams. But yeah, it'll be great to see hopefully him get some really good minutes in that game as we really try to lock down a good spot in the third round with the FIFA rankings so important in terms of where we sit in and in what group we're allocated. All right, we'll move along, Derek. One of your favourite topics, if we've ever got an opportunity to discuss a particular nation in world football, if we've got a spare minute, we always do try to talk about Scotland, one of the home nations who will be at the Euros. So, what did you want to let us know this week about the Scots?
Well, it won't be long before they're walking out against Germany, Rob. I mean, they are the opening act of the Euros, and what an honour and what a terrific encounter that could be if they can become the bogey team for Germany. Obviously, it didn't go not quite as badly as England, but not amazingly to plan. They had a 2-2 draw with Finland in their last game leading into this tournament. Manager Steve Clarke, who has worked miracles with there's no superstars in the team. It's a very collective effort. It's all about system, work rate, etc. He said that the substitutes he made to give players some minutes had an effect on the game and allowed Finland to get back in. They were 2-0 up when he made a raft of substitutions in that game. Of course, Scotland will be without Australia's own Lyndon Dyke, so he's devastated to have missed the tournament. So could be Shankland, who they put up there, or Che Adams. Will be leading the line for Scotland. Goals will be a premium, I fear, for them in this tournament. But the Tartan Army, as usual, there's been some good banter leading into the tournament. The squad announcement video, if anyone hasn't seen it, was very funny. And I'm sure Scotland will add an awful lot of value no matter how far they go. Let's hope they can do better than the group stage. But yeah, just going to use this little bit of time we had, Rob, to say, you know, good luck to the lads, and hopefully they can do something over Germany in a few days from now.
Yeah, well, good luck to the Scots. We know famously, I know you're at your hand up there, Edge, but I'll just complete my point before you chime in, that the opening match for a home nation has proven a little too difficult for some, particularly in World Cups over the journey. But I'm going to talk a little bit about Germany's final game of their preparation against Greece in stoppage time. So I just feel that they might have the chops to get through the Scots in that game, Edge.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to let our listeners and you guys know that obviously I keep a very close eye on the reseller market, on the tickets for these major events, and I know when a country is excited because the prices of their tickets go through the roof. Can I tell you, if you're a Scotland fan and you want to get a ticket at the last moment, you better have €3,000. That is as high a price as I've ever seen. So I say the Scottish fans out there, they've been waiting for a long time. They've been probably putting the pennies in the piggy bank over the last 20 years, Derek, and I'd say they're letting loose, and we might see a lot of them in the stadium, I'd say.
Hopefully.
I hope so. They're pretty lively when they get there. Even if there's not a lot of them, it will feel like a lot of them.
It will. It always does. The Euros, the colour of the Euros is always one of the most enjoyable things to watch. That's for sure. The World Cup does, but, you know, sometimes just doesn't bring that same sort of colour across the stadiums, the hardcore fans that don't have to travel too far, and it costs probably a little bit less to get there. So if they can afford their $3,000 ticket, then hopefully we'll see plenty of Scots in there against die Mannschaft. Gentlemen, thank you. Michael, we'll talk to you later in the week. Will you still be in Mexico City when we do stoppage time?
Yeah, I will actually. Yeah, no, looking forward to that. And so much to talk about. I want to give stoppage time a bit of a plug. Derek's got a big one. The old Premier League civil war between Manchester City and the Premier League. I'll tell you what, there's some very interesting things going to come out of that in the next few months. So, listeners, make sure you listen to Derek's report on the Premier League civil war in stoppage time.
Did he set you up, Derek?
Yeah, good throw, Edge. I'm looking forward to discussing that.
Excellent. All right. And Adam Maloney, thank you very much, my friend, for editing and producing and pulling this whole thing together and getting it loaded for our listeners to have a listen to at their leisure. Now, if you have a moment, as we always ask you to do, you know what I'm about to ask you to do. Please leave a review wherever you listen to your favorite shows and make sure you subscribe to all of our shows, Box to Box, Stoppage Time. And if you haven't listened to Offside before, you heard us listening to Heather, get onto our feed and have a listen to the Heather Reid edition of Offside. It was a fabulous one. She really talks about a lot of that history. Make sure you tweet us at Box to Box NTS and follow us on X, like us on Facebook if you haven't already, and join us throughout the week as our podcasts drop and we go from one end of the pitch to the other in the World Game.